Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So here we are. Do you know how long we've been doing this, Mark? And I had a reminder of this week by the miracle of Apple Photos, I think it is, that shows you old pictures taken on this date in years past that you've kept on your hard drive or whatever. And it had a picture of us recording a podcast at Abbey Road. Do you remember this? I remember that vividly.
Yeah, it was Andrew Harrison, you, me, Matt Hall, and Kate Mossman, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. We had the traditional picture taken going across the zebra,
going across the studio too,
and we recorded the actual podcast in another studio there. And the reason we recorded that podcast there was to celebrate our 100th podcast, right? How long ago was and our 100th podcast, Mark? This bears just stressing.
Well, was it 2011? No, when
it's
was it?
12 years ago we did our 100th. So, you know, people very often say, how many have you done? And strictly speaking, I don't really know how many we've done because, you know, we did it in the early days, we did it in a quite haphazard way. And then Matt Hall came along. So Matt said, you've got to do it weekly, you know, which is very good advice, you know.
Yeah.
And we'd largely done it weekly ever since. And so, but there's been odd changes of format, transfer from one host to the other and so forth. So the actual number, I would not know. But let me tell you this.
It's hundreds.
Let me just say this to every other wet behind the ears, Harry Veast, Johnny Come Bloody Lately, Leaper, belated Leaper on the podcast bandwagon. We were there before the lot of you. And if you want proof, go and look.
I know. Every day there's a kind of, Rob Brydon started a podcast. Mate, can I catch
don't
up?
Tell me.
Come on.
Yes, absolutely.
Where have you been?
So I just thought I'd stress that. It's worth talking about.
Our
heritage.
I'm proud of it. And I remember that podcast very well because Andrew Harrison tells the Van Morrison harmonica story.
Oh, is it that
very,
one?
Very, very amusingly. It's a kind of greatest hits performance. Yes, he just retells stories that people really like.
It's like Don McLean doing American Pie, isn't it?
Do Van Morrison. Do some old.
Yeah. So talking of some old, something else that somebody sent me this week, and you know that people are always sending things from Whistle Test saying, do you know you did this on Whistle Test? And we tend to say, I have no memory of it whatsoever. And then they send you the link and you see it. This is 1983. This is me introducing an item on Whistle Test about the apparent miracle of computerized music. You've seen this, haven't you?
I've seen it.
Because you're there at the end.
Reminded me that I was also present. I had absolutely no memory of it. And it may have been, no disrespect to your stunning presentational skills, but it may have been the actual quality of the item itself. Because
they didn't trust you to do it, Mark. They didn't trust you with machinery.
No, they certainly didn't, quite rightly.
Presenter has got to be able to press the button here.
And you're doing it on live telly. And I hope this works. I love that idea that it might not work. You know.
But anyway, the point is, it's the two apparently miraculous records. One is a new single by Chris Seavey, and the other is a new record by Pete Shelley as a solo performer. And in both cases, they're miraculous. You know, hold on to your hats. A dazzling surprise that they're going to offer is that if you load the tape of these singles into your ZX Spectrum computer, total memory 12K, okay, 12K, you can somehow get it to read out the lyrics of this thing alongside playing the music.
The lyrics come out as like a sort of ticker tape, don't they? And I have to say that as a piece of television, it is sensationally uninteresting. But it is, it's at the time, it was probably pretty fascinating.
I'll tell you why it was fascinating, because it's come back to me, because the prime mover behind this item was the director of Whistle Test at the time, Tom Corcoran.
Tom.
And Tom, apart from his many other qualities, was a very early geek. He really was.
Yeah. He was.
And in the days when it was BBC computers and, you know, only geniuses knew how to rig these things up to get them to do very unremarkable things. And so he was the guy who wanted this to happen. He brought in a humongous great telly from home to line it up next to this computer and play these things together.
I think I've got a recollection of doing something about CDs as well. The incredible new unbreakable format that will change the world, you know. And it made Whistle Test briefly feel like tomorrow's world.
You know what I mean?
It's as if you and I should have got out of our check shirts and put on white lab coats and expression.
But let me ask you this. You see, back then, we used to sort of believe in the future. We believed that there were technological barriers and they would be approached at some point in the future, and you know, things would be delivered to you in different means and quicker and so forth. I don't think we believe that any longer, because we sort of think if technology is capable of doing something, it ought to be doing it right now, you know. And I can't sit here and think, how could the delivery of music, for instance, be better at some point in 2 years in the future than it is now? The only way people can think of it being better is if it goes back to, you know, vinyl and things like that. I don't think anybody's sitting here saying, wouldn't it be great to have music as a kind of implant or something like that? I don't think they are.
Couldn't we have it any faster? It's not immediate enough, you know. You can't, you know, absolutely everything you want you can get straight away and with visuals, you know. You're right. But the thing about that old bit of footage on the telly that reminded me, it made me think of how good, actually, the old Whistle Test things in the 70s were, when they used to think, how can we illustrate this song? And rather than just printed out lyrics, as we saw on that thing, you know, they had, you know, Felix the Cat cartoons for Jefferson Starship and 20s flappers dancing to Trampled Underfoot by Led Zeppelin. Do you remember that?
They were really good. I know. I'll tell you where that stuff used to come from. It came from a company called Film Finders.
Yeah.
Which was run by Philip Jenkinson, who used to be one of the hosts of Late Night Lineup. You'll have seen him on telly numerous times, who was a very serious film buff. And I think it was probably in the days, how can I put this diplomatically? I think it was in the days when multinational movie and media conglomerates did not have huge legal departments going around issuing cease and desist orders.
Saying, hang on, you stole a piece of our footage and put it in the Old Great Whistle Test, which they did, didn't they?
Absolutely, they did, you know.
Yeah.
And so the irony is that stuff, which was put on in order to have a way of illustrating music when before people did videos, you couldn't show it any longer because you couldn't clear it any longer.
Yeah.
Whereas in those days, it was still sufficiently the Wild West for you to be able to get away with it.
Yeah, look, some Betty Boop footage. Stick that onto, you know, Van de Graaff generator.
And also, Betty Boop is now officially too saucy to be on the television.
Now, absolutely right.
Because the animators used to keep themselves amused, didn't they, by occasionally they'd insert a frame where she'd neglected to wear her underwear.
That's right.
Which
would they would probably would freeze that frame and tweet it vigorously.
And they're the director general.
Heap shame upon the boob.
The director general of the BBC would resign.
Yeah, he'd have to resign. He'd have to apologise. That's right. So then he'd be out.
Further variations on theme of things aren't what they used to be. A friend was telling me the other day. He runs a large theatrical opera company, and when they do dress rehearsals, they invite friends and family of the audience of the cast come along. You know, it doesn't cost anything and so forth. And so traditionally, what they do to defray some of the cost at the end is they go out with the old plastic bucket. You know, as people are exiting, exiting. People are perfectly used to that, aren't they? And people chuck in a couple of quid or a fiver or whatever. So at the end of the evening, you might end up with 300 quid or something, you know, and it's worth doing. Of course, now we're in the cashless society.
All that's gone.
You can't do that anymore.
And so, what did they raise? Can you remember?
You make an appeal and you say, if you'd like to make a donation, you can do it online. £17.50. £17.50, as opposed to £300. And it just made me think, God, you know, the implications of the cashless society for all kinds of
things. That's amazing. And cash, there's something irreplaceably thrilling about it. I can remember Nick Lowe once telling me that there is absolutely no feeling to replace that of returning, this is a few years ago, returning from doing a gig with a ton in cash in your pocket.
Oh, yeah.
And it's true. You know, you get home and there's a brick of cash, you know, you can just tear off great chunks of it and throw it at this and throw it at that. It's a lovely feeling.
We used to work with an old ad man who used to talk about that, having enough cash in his pocket. Printers, particularly. Printers and cab drivers were always holding folding. As Ron used to say. And he said, they've got a brick of cash big enough to choke a donkey. I still think about that, but you're quite right. The thrill of cash. And of course, this is a huge thing in pop music. I've been putting together a compilation CD, multi-CD thing. And one of the tracks on it is by the great Jesse Winchester, the opening track of his first album, which is called Payday. And it's, I think the opening couplet is, let's go out on the town tonight. My pockets
are heavy
with loot.
That's it.
Heavy with loot. Isn't that
loot's a great phrase, as if you somehow stole it in the first place.
Oh, that's gorgeous. And of course, if you go back further, you got the Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind, you know, which we all remember. You know, tonight I'll spend my bread, tonight I'll lose my head tonight.
That's right. The idea
is on Thursday you had nothing.
Yeah.
On Friday you've got everything. And on Saturday you'll probably have nothing.
You'll have nothing again.
Because that's the way it
works.
But
it's about very small sums of money comparatively. It's about enough money. It's not life changing. It's day changing, isn't it? It's enough money to get you absolutely plastered and get a huge hangover
and impress a girl.
Exactly. And
whereas, you know, hip hop is hugely, you know, it talks about cash a lot. You know, I've got to get paid, all that kind of thing. But what that is talking about is enormous sums, isn't it? Of life changing, if you were sensible, but probably not. You know, that's talking about tens of thousands of dollars, isn't it?
Rather than
enough to get through the weekend.
But I love the feeling that in so many songs back in the day, you got that very physical feeling of the texture and almost the touch of money. You know, do you remember all the folk songs about the greenback dollar? There's always mentions of bills and bucks and nickels and lousy dimes.
Yeah.
There's a great, in Stormy Monday, there's a great line. It goes, the eagle flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out to play. Because there's an eagle on the back of a probably still is. The eagle flies on Friday. It means I get cash.
I did not know that.
The eagle there, which means I'm going to take off because I've got the money to be able to fly with. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow. Well, it's like, what was that? Who did It's All About the Benjamins?
It was Puff Daddy, wasn't it? Yeah.
Benjamin Franklin's on a $100 note,
yeah,
I think.
That's right. The dead presidents.
But he wasn't a president, Benjamin Franklin.
No. There's a great history lesson. There's a great hip hop song that 70s Johnson used to play in the Word Office called "Turn My Swag On" by Soldier Boy, which is about making huge amounts of money. It's bling. It's about kind of dressing up and making money. And he has a great line. He says, "I'll be making paper like you wouldn't believe." That's a lovely line. Making paper. That's holy fun. And the other thing about cash is you can. The sound of it, the genius of money by the Pink Floyd is the sound of the cash deals.
It is.
The genius of money in cabaret is, you know, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, the clinking, clanking sound. That's fantastic, I think. You cannot get that sensation, Dave, from a bank transfer, can you? I don't know, maybe it could.
Has anybody? So there's a challenge to the massive. Has anybody written recently a song that reflects the modern ways of people getting compensated or paying for things, you know, which are, you know, hold your phone over the swipe machine or whatever, you know. I'd be interested to see if anybody's done it. Do you remember, you must have had jobs where you were paid in cash weekly.
Yeah.
And they used to turn up and they give you the cash. And they had these beautiful envelopes.
And they had a little bit with holes in it.
They had a window.
See through.
They had a window, and they would lay out the notes, the different denominations of notes in such a way that they fanned them out.
Yeah, you could see them all.
Count how many ones or how many fives were in there. And then the coins would be visible below, because the idea is you could count it without breaking the seal.
Without breaking the seal.
And if
I worked in a tractor factory when I left school for about 3 or 4 months, and I can remember on Fridays you got your wage packet. Remember that? In a Brahmin or envelope, exactly the envelope you're talking about.
Yeah.
I can even remember what it was. It was £23.40 for a week, and that was just seemed a massive amount. Ridiculous.
Know. Yeah, and when you did overtime, so. Couple of weeks later, you get significantly more.
Yeah.
You know, that was just unbelievably thrilling.
But that's another thought, isn't it? It's all about the idea that you saved up to buy a record or whatever.
Oh.
You physically saved up. You know, you'd actually put money aside. I love that idea. I remember going to stay with John Peel once when we were at Word. We just started Word and I was doing an interview and I stayed overnight at his house and he had a little jar for £2 coins in the kitchen. And everybody put the £2 coins in. When there was enough, they all went out and had a pizza. I thought, that's such a lovely idea. And I wonder if people still do that. I don't know.
No.
Probably not, because they don't have £2 coins. You know?
You probably, if you're like me, you've probably got in your house somewhere a jar that contains coins that you put in there last February.
Right.
And you haven't, there you go.
Here's one with foreign currency in it, which is just completely useless. In really.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be useless even when we can all go out.
I know.
Now, just while we're dealing with important issues, what's the most stupid two words anybody can ever put on an album cover? I'm going to tell you.
Go on.
The most stupid two words, and they appear on loads of album covers. Play loud.
Oh, yeah, play loud. Oh, I quite like that.
What's that?
Well, somebody had an album. Was it Slade had a record called Play It Loud or something? Wasn't that the second album?
Oh, I don't know.
It's on a Stones album. It's on Let It Bleed, I think it says.
It is.
So this record should be played loud. I like that idea. I mean, let's get the party started. Let's kick off.
I found that I was looking at this. The reason I was thinking of that, I found this yesterday. Prefab Sprout, Steve McQueen.
Sure, that didn't say Play Loud, did it?
There you go.
You're kidding me.
It says, due to the exceptional length of this record, play loud. Now, that's...
Well, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Doesn't make any sense at all. Because if you're going to play it louder and it's, you know, its signal isn't that high, all you're going to hear is more surface noise, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're not going to hear any more of the...
That's incredible. Do they have that on Everything But The Girl records? Can I buy a Young Marble Giants album with Play Loud?
Play Quiet.
Gavin Newsom. Is probably, I don't know.
Has anybody ever put a record out called Play Quiet? You know, that. And also, it's subjective. You know, we make the judgment ourselves, can't we, as to whether something needs to be turned up or not.
No, it's up to us. But I still like the idea that it means there's a party waiting to be had here, so get involved.
Okay.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Somebody sent me a picture this week of somebody in Sydney, Australia, who was celebrating their 50th birthday, and they decorated the back yard with the kind of livery of my 1971 book. They painted 1971 all over their garage door.
It's very gratifying.
So
that's really touching.
Yeah.
So I'd love to see that.
I'll send it to you later. So
yeah,
50 years ago, round about this week, was it Joni Mitchell's Blue came out?
Almost exactly this week. I think it's about a week's time. I know. God, I can remember that coming out. God, that was a big deal, wasn't it?
I'd have a heart break.
Maybe it wasn't a big deal instantly.
I don't think it was instantly.
You know, because
she put out records quite frequently in those days, as did many people in those days, you know, so there was less fanfare about each individual one, you know. But I was just looking at the original review in Rolling Stone.
Oh, this is good.
Timothy Krause, and he says he's kind of generally appreciative, but you know, it's very much, you know, he's only just heard it kind of thing. You know, he hasn't lived with it or anything like that. And he certainly doesn't herald it as if it is one of the greatest records of all time, which of course nowadays it gets into loads of people's lists, you know, of those kind of things. But it's interesting that he says that that certain songs you just can't work out what they're about at all. He says Little Green will be one of them.
Yeah.
He says dressed up in such cryptic references, it passeth all understanding.
Well, we didn't know for what, 20 years, did we? Because Little Green was about the birth of her. Well, she gave up her daughter for adoption, I think, in 1965. And I think she reunited with her 30 years later.
By the time
they'd actually met, I think her daughter had become a mother too. So she became a mother and a grandmother overnight. Yeah. And interesting
her own mother was still alive.
Yes, that's right.
There were suddenly four generations.
I know, incredible.
Yeah.
And interestingly, she sort of, I think, at that point stopped. She put out there was an album she'd been working on. I forgot what it's called. I think it's called Taming of the Tiger. She then put out the orchestral reworkings of her songs. There was one more album, I think, in 2007, slightly half-hearted, and she kind of retired. So maybe that had some kind of effect on her. I think she said this, actually.
Yeah. I think she's admitted, you know, saying this, that it made such a difference to her life that they the creative urge was a form of compensation.
Absolutely.
In the 70s and the 80s, you know, but it's...
I do think
it's really interesting that it's one of those records where people often say, well, I think she said herself, it was like an X-ray, you know, I had no personal defences. I felt like a cellophane wrapper on a pack of cigarettes. I felt like I had absolutely no secret from the world and I couldn't pretend in my life to be strong or to be happy. And, but of course, she wrote that song, Little Green, and nobody knew what it was about.
No, no, no.
And now that we know, you've got a far clearer, it has a reality that other songs don't have. Because you know it's the literal truth, isn't it? You know about what must have been a terrible wrenching, you know, incident in our life. Whereas the other songs, they could be about James Taylor, they could be about David Blue, they could be about Graham Nash. You don't really know. You know, you can apply them if you want, but it's just interesting. You know, we always think we can tell things about people's lives from the songs on their records. And I don't really know whether you can, because they're just songs, aren't they? You know, they're just compositions, and you know, whatever scans or whatever makes a good title or whatever is more important than whether it's the literal truth about
but the difference this. Between her, because there were people at the time you thought you knew a bit about. I mean, Leonard Cohen, you know, he did Nancy and Suzanne and Marianne. You know, the people that he who were in his world seemed so exotic and fabulous, but there's no actual detail about that life. There's a little bit in Paul Simon's songs. America's a really good example where they're on the Greyhound bus, you know, and his tie is really a camera, and the man in the gabardine coat is a spy, and all that. You can imagine that kind of world that they'd inhabit, and you wanted to have those kind of conversations yourself. But the thing about Joni Mitchell was that there's lots of details in those songs that really make them come alive and make them possible to picture. They're like plays, I think. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? The last time I saw Richard, it was a kind of a conversation. But there's a bit that the barmaid came by in fishnet stockings and a bow tie and said, "Drink up now, it's getting on time to close." Those are brilliant, brilliant, brilliant just details. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet. I'm going to rent a grand piano and put flowers around the room. You know, the clean white linen, the fancy French cologne. I think you've got a real idea of the fabric of her life.
I love the references. She does it in loads of her records, to the clean white linen. And
yeah.
It's always... The thing about Joni Mitchell is she's never made any secret about the fact she loves luxury.
Yeah.
You know, me, I play for fortunes and the curtain calls and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
She likes the fancy life. She likes the five-star life because she lived the other kind of life as well.
She did.
And she doesn't want to make any pretense about it at all. And it's a real addition to the song. I've just realized I wrote down a really bad couplet from Blue, and I've written on a piece of paper over there. I'm going to go and find
it. Go get it. I can't believe there's a bad couplet on Blue. There are a lot of good ones. My Old Man's got some lovely lyrics in it. The bed's too big, the frying pan's too wide. Those are just fantastic images, I think. Everyone can relate to. So good. Go, tell us the bad couplet.
Oh, God, what did I write it down? Oh, there we go. I think it's on California. Okay. Defend this, Mark Ellen. I'm going to see the folks I dig.
Oh, I'll even kiss the sunset. Pig. That's poor.
I'm sorry, Joni.
That's poor. No, that is. There are some good others. Going to Spain, you go down a dirt track road or something, and lots of pretty people there reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. That's a fantastic line. I love that. The idea that, you know, these outposts to the one, and America is leading the way with Rolling Stone and Vogue. What do you think
about applause, applause? Life is our cause. When I feel your kisses, my mind seesaws. But she gets away with it. Because of the way she does it, you know.
But I can't think of another musician that you felt you knew as much about. You're probably right. I mean, it probably was utterly fictional, but you had a very clear life of the view of the world she inhabited, and felt incredibly strong bonds towards. I can remember going with my girlfriend to Crete in whenever we were in 1974, and going to Matala. Why? Because she had been to Matala in one of her songs, and had hung around in the caves. The beach tar on my feet. The wind is in from Africa. I mean, that's how powerful a pull it was on me.
The wind is in from Africa is a wonderful opening.
Yeah, last night I couldn't sleep. It's fantastic. Oh,
but I don't think, you know, I'm not sure whether these things are all literally true. It's just that people they mine their own lives, don't they, for ideas, and then they put them alongside other ideas, and you know, it's like, you know, was that old line about when a writer enters a family, the family is no more, because they take
and expose
absolutely everything, you know.
All columnists say that, don't they? Everything is raw material.
Everything is raw material.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, yeah, so 50 years ago this week, and if you haven't got it, well, go and get it. Go and get it. Joni Mitchell's Blue.
Also 1971, that fantastic clip that you sent me, that someone had sent you group. Oh, my God, it's so sweet.
Oh, I've got to find this.
The story is a group was called Kinky Machine. And Kinky Machine played their farewell concert at the Woodville Halls in Gravesend in 1971. And what they've done, and this has happened quite a bit during lockdown, is that the remaining members of Kinky Machine, who I think is all of them, possibly apart from the drummer, who are spread out all over the world now, have reunited and made this little video. They've written a new song, and it's a lovely little self-explanatory song that sort of talks about their old life in 1971 in Gravesend, and also their new life now, you know. And they're very sweet. They formed in a place called the Telly Tea Bar.
Yeah.
Which they said, an unprepossessing cafe with a jukebox playing All Right Now and Layla alternatively until unplugged. And the whole thing is about looking back on the old haunts, isn't it? There was a pub called the Borough Shades and the pub called the Prince of Orange, and they have little pictures of them, what they look like now. The details are amazing, what they look like now and what they look like then. It's fantastic.
It is fantastic. We'll post it, actually. Say it's really worth seeing. And it was Keith Peacock that sent that to us.
And they're a really nice bunch of really well-preserved, cheerful blokes. There they are with their lovely wives. I think some of the wives might have been in the band too, actually. I tell you what they reminded me of, actually, if we were on a bit of a hippie trip. They remind me of a group called Global Village Trucking Company.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they sound very like them, you know, who had that kind of Ian Dury kind of what went on to be kind of like Madness, that kind of sort of upbeat, umpah kind of music hall vibe about them. And Global Village Trucking Company had been going in 1970. I saw them in 1974, I remember, in Oxford. And they reformed not long ago. And I love that. And the interesting pop fact about the Global Village Trucking Company was there was a rumour that the keyboard player, James Lascelles, was the second son of the 7th Earl of Harewood and also the stepson of Jeremy Thorpe. Well, and it turned out in real life that actually he was the second son of the 7th Earl of Harewood and was the stepson of Jeremy Thorpe because his mum went on to marry each other. And he was the first cousin once removed to the Queen of Elizabeth II and in line to the succession to the British throne. That is pretty amazing. All those things were true. People would go, they'd come on stage and go, oh, it's Jeremy Thorpe's son, or, you know, he's in line to be the King of England. You go, get off, you know. Turns out he was.
That would have been really good because Pete Frame could have done a family tree which had the Global Village Trucking Company on one side and the kind of House of
Prince
Hanover
Philip on the other. That's right.
Just go on forever. That's brilliant. Well,
I wonder if there was a posher person in rock. I doubt it, actually. That's terrific, isn't it?
If you know a posher person in rock, please get in touch.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Any other business? We're joined by Alex Gold. How you doing, Alex? My God, you got a lot of hair, haven't you?
Yeah, it's definitely going south at a rapid rate.
It's good.
I'm going to be chopping it off in the next couple of months, though, I think. I'm actually seriously thinking about keeping it when it's being cut and getting it fashioned into my next John Lennon wig.
Oh, a wig made out of your own hair. That'd be amazing.
It's expensive, isn't it? I quite like the idea of that.
That's bizarre. Yeah. Because it really, you are very, it's very Abbey Road now, isn't it? Actually?
It is.
Same colour, everything.
That's true, actually.
Yeah, it's
good. Let's have a look at you in profile as if you're walking across the zebra. It's good. If you've got a white suit, Alex, you got a white suit. Put your hands in your pockets.
And gym shoes.
I've got it all in my cupboard over there. That's the thing. But this is actually better than my John Lennon circa 1969 wig.
Very good.
Really got me thinking.
Talking to the Beatles. John Dredge, who sent me, he found an old ad for Bassett's Jelly Babies from presumably the 1960s. And the copy goes, "We name no names, but a certain pop group is believed to rate Jelly Babies top of the sweet parade, blah, 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 blah." And of course, well, you don't remember, Alex, because clearly you weren't there, but we do remember that during the height of Beatlemania, girls used to pelt the Beatles with Jelly Babies because they'd once said in an interview that they liked Jelly Babies or one of them had or whatever. And they used to, after a while, they complained about this. And it's only now when I look at that ad that John sent in, I thought, I'm not surprised they...
Can you imagine?
What must it have been like?
It's kind of smart, hasn't it? A handful of Jelly Babies raining down like shrapnel from the gallery.
And God, I mean, they're heavy as well, aren't they, Jelly Babies? Yeah. You know, with Smarties, not so much of a problem. But a Jelly Baby catching you on the forehead, you'd know about it, wouldn't you?
A Jelly Baby's quite dense. You know, its exterior belies its density. So I imagine there's a projectile. There's a lot of purchase in a Jelly Baby.
Well, thanks for that, John. We've also, another feedback from Patreons and friends. Chuck Lonson in Savannah, Georgia, sends this. He wants to know how many original members must take part in a concert or album in order for it to be really considered that particular band. The Stones are down to 3 original members. Yes. Could just Keith and Mick carry on as the Stones? Would Ringo and Paul be the Beatles? Could just Paul and John have been the Beatles? Pete and Roger are still the Who. Could it have been Daltrey and Entwistle? You know, which individual's participation is so integral that losing one person ends the band, no matter how many originals remain? It's a good point. Well put, Chuck.
Very good point. But McCartney and Ringo as the Beatles, there'll be a riot.
Yeah, oh, they will be a riot.
God, the Beatles would go. It would sell less tickets than McCartney on his own. Yeah, or Ringo on his own.
Beatles, actually. Different case, I think totally we're going to say. Case. Different case. 4 and 2 have gone, you know, I don't know.
I think if you have a writer or writers in the group, you'd have to have those writers present to to make it feel like it was the group.
Right.
I don't think you could have the Who without Townsend, for example.
Well, if you had the Who without Townsend right now, it would be a Roger Daltrey show, wouldn't it?
It would.
Literally. So,
God forbid.
You
know,
you couldn't have Roger Daltrey.
You couldn't have the Kinks without Ray Davies. You probably couldn't have Oasis without Liam Gallagher, actually, although clearly Noel sings some of the songs. He just doesn't sing. Couldn't have the Pretenders without Chrissie Hynde. Sting, not in the Police. That doesn't really work, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Mind you, there are groups who've carried on without the lead singers, haven't they? Stranglers did all right, didn't they? The Undertones. Gang of Four at the very end was just one member of Gang of Four who was the guitar player who never sung, Andy Gill. So
the Gang of Four was one, was it?
One member of the Gang of Four who was not the singer. They were still called Gang of Four. That's amazing, isn't it?
That's a different level, isn't it?
Because it is.
If you're a Gang of Four fan, you kind of know what you're getting, don't you?
Yeah. You're buying the concept of the Gang of Four.
You are.
The band.
Whereas out of the Who or whatever, that's the Who without Pete Townsend. That would feel like selling tickets under false pretenses.
It really would do. The Clash reforming now with no Joe Strummer would be just utterly wrong.
Did the Clash do anything without Joe Strummer?
I'm pretty sure they nearly did. Pretty sure they nearly reformed for, I think it was a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing with Bruce Springsteen taking the Strummer position.
That's got to value all of his own.
That's got a bit of a magnetic pull.
That's improved, there. Actually.
Yeah.
No, but the logic was apparently that Strummer is the closest thing to being. Springsteen's the closest thing to being Joe Strummer's counterpart in terms of what he stands for and everything like that. So, yeah, I could live with that.
Well, but you know, there's there was a time when the concept of Marillion without Fish was inconceivable, but they've both had very good careers, haven't they? They've had no Fish for absolutely years now. You probably just have to go out and prove it all again, don't you? Really, is the truth. You've got to get through that point where people go, no, actually, the new bloke's really good.
Yeah,
you know, they're actually better with this person. You sort of have to do that before people will accept it. But I think the answer to your question is, Chuck, there's no hard and fast rule, really. This debate will no doubt
case by case issue.
It's a case by case.
Yeah,
and we'll set ourselves up as consultants. You know, for a fee, we will tell you if your proposed lineup of your reformed group is taking money under false pretenses or not. Shall we do that? I asked if anybody had any questions to put to the jury. While we were doing this podcast, and somebody asked, who was it? Brian Cannon Hunter, which film have you watched the most times? Because we were talking about this only the other day, weren't we? That there are certain films that you just watch.
Is that a music film or just a film?
No, it's any film, I think. I'm sure it's just any film. I'll go first. And the acid test of this is, if you're walking through the living room and these films are on the television, do you sit down, first of all, on the edge of a sofa, pretending you're only going to be there for a little while, and then after a while you slip down into the main body of the sofa and you're clearly there until the end of the film? And I'm a sucker for certain things. If any Ealing comedy is on the television as I'm going through the room, I sit down straight away, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely anything made in Ealing, you know. And
Lady Killers, fantastic.
The Lady Killers, anything like that. But also, more recently, the film that I watched again and again and again, and I absolutely love, is Master and Commander.
I've seen that.
Russell Crowe. Peter Weir film based on the Patrick O'Brien books. I think it's a fantastic film, that. And it's just, I also forget loads of the plot, which is quite a strength in a film. When you go back to it, you think you're reintroduced to things. You think, oh, yes, of course, that happens. And then that happens.
There's so many episodes. There's the bit where they get becalmed and the kind of mental state begins to unravel. I mean, it's absolutely great.
And the Galapagos.
Galapagos, they have to abandon all the creatures. Yeah,
and the drama at the beginning. And I think it's such a good film. And if you haven't seen it, go and see it. But also something else, which I don't think is a particularly work of genius or anything like that, but I've watched it loads of times. And I actually sent you, I nudged you on it the other day. I said, this is on the BBC iPlayer. Go and watch it. Which is Margin Call, the film about, thinly disguised version of the kind of Barings Bank type collapse set in
the financial, it's 2008, New York, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's a really, really
fantastic
film. Didn't you think?
Really powerful drama. It's extraordinary. And that's just a play. It's just brilliant dialogue. All taking place as their whole world starts to fall apart. They realise that they're headed for a financial catastrophe. It's just brilliant.
Stars Kevin Spacey, Jeremy Irons. Yeah, Paul Bettany. It's really, really good. I'd recommend that. What about you, Mark?
Well, I would have to just add to that Some Like It Hot. I'm sorry, I can't think how many times I've seen Some Like It Hot. I can't resist it. It's wonderful. I know it has no great hidden depths or anything like that, but there's something incredibly funny and cheering and optimistic and knockabout and beautiful about the whole thing. Just the story, the two, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, their acting abilities, playing their parts in drag, the lines. I think it's gorgeous. It's fantastic.
Also, they're not making that kind of film anymore.
No, they're not.
I mean, that was the other thing, So often, my television, I don't know if it's something to do with the way I use it, but when I turn it on, it opens on, not on BBC One, it opens on Talking Pictures TV. It just does. It defaults to Talking Pictures TV, which is the channel that just runs old movies from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s or whatever. Because I clearly just watch so much of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I wish there were more channels like that. What about you, Alex?
The only film I've ever watched so much that I could recite the whole thing from start to finish and did was the 1986 animated Transformers movie cartoon. I used to watch it on a daily basis, and I could recite the whole thing from start to finish.
So what's the opening line then, Alex?
I couldn't remember that now. God damn it. probably something like Transform. But
all right.
At the time.
We went on a holiday once when our kids were, I think they were about 13 and 11, and they could recite the entire script of Austin Powers.
Oh, wow.
And playing three or four parts each. And, Dr. Evil and the Liz Hurley part and all that. It was so funny. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, you can, can't you? You can memorise the entire thing if you've seen it enough.
Yeah.
Here's a challenging question from Matt Penny. Here's a nice cheery thought. Would you rather live without books or live without music?
Ooh, God. Ooh. Well, it's easier to remind yourself of music because it's in your head.
Yes.
You can just replay records because they're so familiar. You can't replay books. You reread a book and your toes curl up with delight at the phraseology of a certain paragraph. So I think probably the answer is I've got enough music in my head. I don't know, really.
Difficult. I'm going to go a little bit esoteric here and say that all the music you need is within you already.
Hey.
There's a lot of truth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth.
A lot.
Which, another question, I've forgotten who this came from. Somebody was asking, what's the record that you reach for when you're in a bad mood to calm you? Somebody said, it's Billy Hush. But John Peel once said that when he's in a foul mood, he would play Jimmy Reed records to calm down. Do you have a go-to artist or album when the red mist descends? His is Dusty in Memphis. While you're thinking.
Dusty's a good choice. Dusty's a very good choice.
Yes. Not so much a specific record, but a specific kind of record. Scar, any kind of Scar, always lightens your mood.
That's true. We often play an album called Intensified. which is absolutely wonderful. Do you know that compilation?
Yeah, yeah.
It's got the original version of The Higher the Monkey Climbs and songs like that. It's, yeah, there is something utterly reassuring and comforting about Scar.
Yeah, it just lifts you. What about you, Alex?
It's either Everything is Awesome, the Lego song, which is unfailingly cheerful.
Or, go on.
Probably What's the Story, Morning Glory.
Oh, I knew it.
Okay.
You're never going to be too far away from
yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, they're all worthwhile suggestions. Any other business we got to talk about? If you haven't got your tickets already for July 17th in Holland Park, do so, because the excitement is building as we get nearer. Delighted to say Barney Hoskins is now added to our list of raconteurs speakers on the day, in addition to Leslie Ann Jones and Gary Crowley. More to be announced in due course. But please, where should people go and look if they want to book tickets, Alex?
They can go straight to wiyelondon.com. There's a ticket widget on the front page of the website, so nice and easy.
I'm going to finish with a sad story. I bought this. This is the Mirror and the Light, Hilary Mantel. This is the third. It's pretty thick.
Good
the
God.
The third part of a trilogy about Thomas Cromwell. Okay, and it's all kind of engrossing stuff and so forth. But this morning, I just got to page 624. Okay, there's page 624. There's page 625. It's blank.
Oh, my Lord.
It's blank. How do I feel about that? I'll tell you how I feel. Cross. You know, it's the missing page. It's Tony Hancock.
Oh,
it's
that's
Darcy
appalling.
Sarto, The Lady Don't Fall Backwards. All those things.
So and it's not a joke, as it was in The Diary of a Nobody, where there is a blank page, isn't it? It's his thoughts. Do you remember? That's just terrible, though.
That's just ridiculous. And my wife says, well, of course you can take it back. I said, well, yes, I can. But, you know, A, it's a pain in the backside. And B, here's the point. When you've got three quarters of the way through a very, very thick book, do you want it replaced by a new one? I'm saying no.
You're going to do is go to a bookshop, look up page 627 of a fresh copy, read it, memorize it, and then run out or photograph it, possibly. Stick it back on the shelf and leg it.
But I'm saying it's the kind of problem you didn't ought to have to put up with, really.
No, that's a
disgrace.
It's
the kind of thing up with which we will not put.
If this gets back to Hilary Mantel, there'll be a lorry will turn up outside your house and just offload, you know, pallets full of her books.
That's what I need more.
Yes, brick-like tone. yeah.
So we shall see.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.